This is Ross Roja from Hollyweird saying you're watching World Music Views.
So let's get into it. Let's talk first the thing that caused this conversation. Tell me about the archives, the current negotiations that you have with Bogdanovich, and the previous one you had with Michael Leachin.
Well, it wasn't just one previous one with Michael Leachin. It's been a series of attempts over the past 30 years or more to get my life's work to Jamaica, where it truly belongs. I've been obsessed by reggae since 1973. And if you've read anything of mine, I'm always fond of quoting the thing that you as a journalist would appreciate, I think, a lot. The words written that changed my life forever. How words have a power to do that. And it was a gonzo journalist from Australia named Michael Thomas, who wrote a major piece in Rolling Stone that appeared in June of 1973 called The Wild Side of Paradise. It coincided with the international release of Catch a Fire and The Harder They Come film and soundtrack. And he said, reggae music crawls into your bloodstream like some vampire amoeba from the psychic rapids of Upper Niger consciousness. I mean, I was just floored by that. I don't know what the hell this is, but I gotta find this right now. And I was living in Berkeley, and I went out to a used book and record store and found a $2.25 copy of Catch a Fire that opened like the Zippo lighter, the original pressing. And the next night I saw The Harder They Come, and it was in a theater that only seated about 40 people. And when the chalice scene came, everybody in the theater lit up, and there was so much smoke you couldn't see the screen. And on the way home, I bought the soundtrack, and my life has been on a reggae path ever since. I'll tell you the history. I've never done this before with anybody. The history in my mind started at my second Sunsplash in 1983. My first was in 81, that was the memorial to Bob. And I was around the pool at the Seawind Hotel in Mobay, and there were a couple of very interesting looking women sitting nearby, my wife and me, and we struck up a conversation. And they said, well, what brings you here? And I said, reggae. And what kind of comments do you have? And I said, well, I feel very, very frustrated. I mean, here I'm with thousands of people from overseas who came to see the greatest artist in Sunsplash, and there's nowhere to buy records. Outside of Sunsplash, there's no club anywhere having live artists. And you know, it seems to me that you should have some kind of reggae center for foreign tourists who come here specifically drawn by the music, where they can buy the latest releases of the major labels and maybe their oldies that they're paying $20, $30, $40 a piece for. And, you know, generally a place where you can have a show every night guaranteed. You see a local reggae singer in person performing. All the things that a reggae center should have. And it turned out I was talking to Prime Minister Siaga's two sisters. And this was on a Saturday. I recall it vividly. And they said, well, tomorrow afternoon, we'd like to bring somebody over here to meet you and talk to you. And it turned out to be the mayor of Montego Bay. And he came in with these huge charts, maps of the city. And he laid it out on the floor, and he said, now here you see the river comes out to the sea, and we'll give you this land on the edge of the river there for you to build the reggae center. And I said, really? What do I have to do? And he says, well, all you have to do is go back to the States and raise the money. So needless to say, that never happened. Now we cut to, let's see. Well, I quit the Reggae Beat radio show I was doing that I started in 1979 with my partner, Hank Holmes. The music was getting so slack that I can't hear you.
What was this, the first reggae radio show in LA?
Oh yeah, there was no reggae radio on the air in LA at all, and it took us a year to find a station to put us on, and it rapidly became the number one non-commercial radio show in all of Southern California. We raised literally millions of dollars for this little tiny station that just, in fact, a couple of years ago, moved into a $38 million facility. When I started, it was in a junior high school classroom and had a watt that hit the San Diego freeway and died. So we really built, reggae built that station into one of the major national public radio powerhouses, really the West Coast flagship. So in 1987, I quit the Reggae Beat. The music was too slack for me. I didn't want to be promoting that kind of stuff anymore. And I understand it's even worse now. And the head of the Schomburg Institute for Research in Black Culture of the New York Public Library up in Harlem, Howard Dodson, came out to see the collection. And he offered to buy it. He didn't offer me enough, and he wanted to take 5 years to pay for it. And it wasn't right at that time for me to do that. So that was the first offer I turned down. And then in 2001, I was invited by Herbie Miller and the Institute of Jamaica to come and tell them about the archives. And they said they would buy it, and they would try to get a grant from the United Nations, from UNESCO. And that went on for about a year, and eventually UNESCO told them that they could not use the grant for anything that would make money. Well, to me, that's ridiculous. This is Jamaica's heritage. I want them to make as much money as they possibly can. It's only going to be to the benefit of Jamaica. So that didn't work out. And then in 2004, actually, not 2008, Wayne Chen and I got to know each other. And what a beautiful, kind, generous, loving, knowledgeable man Wayne Chen is. I have nothing but enormous respect for him. And he wanted to get his brother, Michael Lee Chin, to buy the archives for Jamaica. Well, it's out in public now, so I guess I can talk about it. All I was asking for the archive was $2 million, knowing that after taxes and everything else, I would end up with half of that. And if my life's work after now 51 years is not worth at least $1 million, then I've wasted my damn life. And, you know, all the money that didn't go to my kids' education or to living a more fruitful life that I spent on 45 records and posters and tapes and stuff would have been, you know, in vain. So I think any fair-minded person would think I was not asking for any outrageous amount of money. And frankly, even at that point in 2004, $2 million was undervaluing it. They brought in, at my request, an evaluator from the American Society of Appraisers. And he came up with a 1.8 million figure, not 1.4, 1.8. And then Mr. Chin, Li Chin, said, there is no receiving body in Jamaica to send this to. And I want to pay you over 3.5 years before I can get the full amount. And I'll put it in a warehouse in Toronto, Canada. Well, that didn't seem to solve any of my problems at all. So I turned it down. And then Minister Grange A few years after that, made a bid that was considerably less than what I had turned down for Mr. Lee Chin. And I don't really understand why she did that, knowing what I'd already turned down. So that didn't happen. And then a few years back, I had a meeting, a brief meeting with Sir Hilary Beckles, the Vice Chancellor of the University of the West Indies Caribbean-wide system. And I said, I haven't raised the price on this in 20 years, and the dollar value has gone down precipitously with the incredible inflation. So I'm giving you an incredible discount. And he said, well, I'll buy it, and we'll set up a committee to find people who will donate money to buy it. Well, that failed. They couldn't wind up, they couldn't end up with enough money, moneyed people in Jamaica who cared enough about their own culture to finance the $2 million purchase. So that fell apart. And then an old friend of mine, Joe Bogdanovich, came aboard. And I knew Joe in the early days of the Reggae Beat radio program in the early 80s when he was living in Los Angeles. And he had my wife, Mary, and me over to his house for dinner several times. And we stayed in touch as he developed Down Sound record label and brought artists to interview on my cable television show. And, you know, we'd kind of lost touch in recent years, but Joe heard the archive still hadn't been sold. And he'd been thinking about building a museum in St. Catharines in Montego Bay, adjacent to the site where he holds his Sumfest Festival.
At Catherine Hall, Catherine Hall.
Catherine Hall, Catherine Hall, right. And so he, in 2018, he said, I will buy your archive and I will build a museum in Montego Bay to house it. Wow, Joe, thank you. You know, 30 years I've been waiting or more for Jamaica to finally get on the ball and realize that this should have been built 40 years ago when I was talking to Siaga's sisters, you know, all the money they've lost over the years by not having a facility like this. You know, the museum is really the reggae center. So Joe flew me down in 2018 to Sumfest to make a formal announcement, because he was about to sign a contract for the land in Montego Bay with the UDC, Urban Development Commission. And everything they had negotiated when he finally got the contract from them was not in the contract. So he couldn't sign the contract. He couldn't announce the sale of the archive. And that was a tremendous frustration. So shortly after, he said, well, the heck with it, I'm going to buy it. And we had a verbal contract, and he gave me a little bit of a 10% down payment. Well, I didn't achieve the entire 10% down payment until last June, after 5.5 years of waiting for it. And I was not living a very extravagant life, to say the least. And then other people started to come around with very deep pockets. I don't want to get into any specifics, but I was offered multiples of what Joe was paying me. Bear in mind now, it's 24 years since I first said 2 million, and that's worth probably about half today in terms of buying power. And I still didn't raise the price because it was going to Jamaica. So these other folks were keenly interested in acquiring it, and they had very deep pockets.
What kind of number did they offer?
I can't give you that number, but let's just say it was multiples of what I was giving it to Joe Bogdanovich for.
5 multiples, 10 multiples?
Nobody's business but mine and them. But I can tell you truthfully, as I talk to you today, I have left millions of dollars on the table. And if the deal with Joe falls through, ultimately, I will take that other deal and Jamaica will not get the archives. But we're racing now under pressure to sign a contract with the rest of what's owed me being paid in a timely manner. So that's where it exists right now. And, you know, with all the valuations that come and go, the archive has doubled in size since it was evaluated, more than doubled. And it's bittersweet to me because so much of what I'm getting now comes from people who are dying or have died and left me their archives, knowing that I promised it would go to Jamaica to be a museum for the benefit of Jamaican people. And I continue to get a fairly regular flow of things, some very important things, very valuable things that I want to add to the museum.
But what it sounds like now is more like a library rather than a museum, because it's a lot of stuff.
Oh, no, it's the library I probably will go to UWE. The library consists of over 140 cubic feet of clippings, all alphabetized. Maybe 3,000 books and magazines from all over the world. My personal files, Howard Dodson from the Schomburg Center told me I should never throw away my fan mail because it documents the spread of reggae throughout the world over the years. So I have six drawers of letters from people involved in the reggae movement all over the planet that I've kept since the mid-80s. Those are very important to historians. There are, oh God, there's countless photographs. I've never been without a camera at my side since I went to Vietnam in 1967 when I got drafted and was there for the Tet Offensive, taking pictures in the middle of the battles. And so I've got over, well, let's talk about reggae pictures. I've probably got a couple of 100,000 reggae pictures. And then there's all the DVDs, the 2,000 hours of DVDs, all the master tapes of my cable television show, which ran for 23 years with Trinidadian director, drummer, Chili Charles. There's all of that material. Scholarly material. So many books have been written out of my archives. It's just ridiculous. And whenever any writer, like if you were coming to LA and wanted to go through the back room.
You're getting me excited. I just left LA a few weeks ago for the
book. Oh, no, really? Now, yeah. How come you couldn't find me? I'm the easiest guy in the world to
find. I asked everybody.
Wow. Well, you asked the wrong everybody.
But I'm happy I find you now. I want us to get into the archives, as in, tell me from what year did you start? Like, what's the number one thing?
Oh, well, obviously, it was the Rolling Stone article. I could bring it out the back room and show it to you right now. It had Countryman on the cover, only they called him Countryman, Cunchy, Countryman. So that became, as I look back now, the first item in Roger Steffens' Reggae Archive. And from that day forward, anything I ran across about Bob Marley, Rastafari, Jamaica, Haile Selassie, all the things, the rich world, even the Bible, which I knew nothing about because I was raised Catholic, all those things that reggae leads you to now fill seven rooms, floor to ceiling of our home. And there's no room left. Mary's got bruises all over her hips from bumping into the piles. It's been an obsession. So it's 51 years of incoming that I'm just so anxious to outgo and put it in Jamaica for people to learn their history and how important Jamaica is to the rest of the world, not just musically, but culturally. I was interviewed by, I'm forgetting his name briefly here, the man who does The Amazing Race, Phil Kogan, a few years ago. And he's been to 130 countries in the course of producing that show. And he said every single place he's been, no matter how small, how remote, has evidence of Bob Marley. And he wanted to know why. And we did a show together with that. And, you know, it said, and I think quite rightly, that anything over 5 years old in Jamaica is forgotten. Mary and I were in Kingston in a big hotel a few years ago, and this 20-year-old girl was waiting on us in the coffee shop. And she said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to speak at a Peter Tosh seminar at UWE." And she looked at me and she says, "Who's Peter Tosh?" I want to correct that. People like you are correcting it. That's why your work is so important, Donovan.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Do you disagree with anything I've said?
No, I'm just soaking up knowledge right now. I'm in heaven, if you know me. I sit at the feet of those who came before me, and I try to learn. So I study you extensively. I studied Timothy White, who started the reggae chart from Billboard. Of course, Blackwell, I sit with him a couple of times. Everybody, John Baker, everybody that has done what I am doing, and they've done their best, right, with what they have. I want to learn from them. And Blackwell said to me one day, he said, I told him I wanted to do a film studio in Port Antonio by Navy Island. And he said, "Donovan, you see the things I didn't get to complete? You're going to have to do them." And I felt responsibility when he said that, because it's so true.
You're one of those people old farts like me always hoped would come along. There's a couple of young guys I've put together in the States, Saul Ramirez and Zeb Brooks, a couple of kids from the Midwest who are Peter Tosh freaks. And they just posted something a couple of hours ago, their first Peter Tosh podcast, and I recommend it to you. John Mazzuri and I are the featured guests on their podcast.
I'll check it out.
Yeah. So, and they're, you know, in their early 20s, and I've been looking for people like that to help foster and to carry on my work. My kids have no interest in it at all. And so I want it to be safe.
You found the right person, because you're going to be my resource guy from now on, all right?
Anytime. Just pick up the phone.
Let's deal with reggae music now. When you were going to Sunsplash, and even before that, Chris Blackwell told me Bob Marley's Catch a Fire only sold 6,000 records first year, end up selling
14.
16. For the first year, but he said the first couple of weeks, 6,000 records.
Oh, first couple of weeks, yeah.
Yeah. Like,
despite the novelty packaging.
Yeah, it flopped basically. And he said, he told the label, put the money behind it, get this record, because we're not going to give up because the first record didn't work. And by October, they were dropping another album, right?
Right.
When you look at that, and you see it, the impresario of that time, who is willing to invest in an artist, look at an artist, see his progression, and focus on him. And then you look at now, where an artist just wants the hit. How do you compare that time to Catch a Fire to now?
Well, there weren't many people like Chris Blackwell who had long-term ideas about most of his important artists. He went to left field to get a lot of people that he put on his label, Mary Ann Faithful and Tom Waits. And, you know, he loved reggae because that was from his country. And he knew that it would take a lot of skillful, shrewd publicity and promotion and money-losing years. but that ultimately he had an artist of such great potential that if he stayed with him, he would make him a superstar. And by God, he did. Didn't always work. The formula didn't always work. And sometimes it was the artist's fault more than anybody else. The Jamaican artists are often given a bad rap for not showing up on time, for doing what Bunny Wailer did, which was to take huge advances and never show up and never give the advances back. And when you have somebody who's being touted as, you know, one of the biggest stars ever from Jamaica beside Bob Marley, his former partner, and he acts like that, it ruins it for all the mid-level artists. And the promoters don't want to take a chance on them. You know, if one of the superstars screws them, what are these other people going to do? So that hurt the movement a lot, especially in the 80s. But I'm going off track here, I think.
You are on track. I want to know, tell me, I like that story, but tell me, what are the things that happened that's causing reggae to now lag in international attention? That's one you just mentioned, where the impression was lost on the legends that didn't show up. What are the factors that are playing into reggae's poor sales right now?
Well, my dear, dear friend, Dr. Matthew Smith, I don't know if you know Matty Dread. Matthew Smith taught at UE for many years, a professor. And he was here in December, having come from a week in Kingston. He lives in London now. And he said the top 10 radio show, the week he was there, couldn't play 7 of the top 10 best-selling songs in Jamaica because they were too obscene. 7 of the top 10. So that's a major factor. And the fact that the dance hall rules so very much of the charts and the attention of the young people, and it's very thick patois, it's not going to attract an international audience. The roots reggae revival seems to have stalled. I don't know if that's true or not. You could fill me in better than I, because I don't really keep too much abreast of the current stuff coming out of Jamaica. It's a variety of factors that have blunted Jamaicans' foreign invasion, if you will. There's no simple solution. I'm a roots man. I'm first generation rock and roll. I grew up on black music, on doo-wop in the 50s under Alan Freed in New York City. Went to all his major shows and saw all the early stars from Frankie Lyman and Buddy Holly and Fats Domino and Jackie Wilson way back in the 50s. And I love good music that means something. And when the 60s came along and added consciousness to rock and roll and the folk movement and Dylan influenced in such a great extent, I loved music even more. And then the little labels all got bought up by the majors, and they destroyed what real consciousness there was by the end of the 60s. And by 73, I was looking for something that would ignite my passions in the way that the harmonies of doo-wop and the consciousness of the 60s did. And all of a sudden, there was Bob Marley in Concrete Jungle. And from the first note, I was hooked. And I was making my living in those days reading poetry. I did a one-man show in schools called Poetry for People Who Hate Poetry. And it was all living English language writers. And E.E. Cummings, who I especially loved, but he was dead. And I had a great love of language, but oddly enough, it was the beat of the music that got to me, the visceral beat of the music, because the great secret of reggae, as you know, is that it is the beat of the healthy human heart at rest. And so it's what you hear in the womb. It's irresistible. And that got me. And then I started to listen to the poetry of Bob's words and Peter's words. Wow, this is I don't know where this comes. How could I not know about this? This is what, 200 miles off the coast of Florida? And I'm into music so deeply my whole life, and I've never heard this. I mean, I heard the Israelites, but nobody called it reggae. I heard My Boy Lollipop, but nobody ever said ska or pronounced it correctly. And I was just flabbergasted. And I was living in Berkeley, which had great import shops. And I started buying the Trojan collections, and it made me realize right away that maybe 90% of what was being recorded in Jamaica was crap. But there were standouts, and when the standouts stood out, they were head and shoulders above everything else that was going on in the rest of the world at that time. And I just wanted to find everything I could about anything to do with reggae music, and especially the Wailers. And I saw Bob for the first time in 1975 in the Oakland Paramount, a big two-tiered auditorium, three-tiered auditorium, where they used to do the ballet. And he sold the place out on 3 days' notice. And I'd never seen a whirling dervish on stuck marionette, wild dreadlock dancing Zen master all in one. It was just only the greatest performers that I'd ever seen in my life bore a comparison to what I saw that night on stage with Bob Marley. And you know, from the time I heard Catch a Fire in 73, I wanted to tell everybody I loved about this music. Ultimately we met a guy in San Francisco on Fillmore Street who had a record store called Trenchtown Records. I've got his card on my desk over there. And his name was Ruel Mills, and he didn't have a lot of records, but they were all prime. They were Count Ossie and the Mystic Revelation of Rastafari, records you'd buy just for the name on the label. And Ross Michael and the Sons of Negus and Alton Ellis and Slim Smith and the Techniques and the Gladiators. And oh my God, it was just insanely good. And he had a tremendous influence on the West Coast Three. There's three white DJs who were really important. And I don't mean to be conceited, but I was one of them in LA. And Duppy Doug Went, the goner who goes there. Up in San Francisco, who was on a commercial radio station in Marin County near San Francisco in 1974, playing reggae music. And he said, I'm not going to play it on anything but commercial radio. And he was one of the only commercial DJs ever in America playing reggae. And then there was Lance Linares in Santa Cruz, which is a hotbed of reggae to this day, who ended up playing Bob Marley in 79 live in concert in Santa Cruz on his station, KUSP, and bringing Black Uhuru with Puma to Soledad Prison to do a free concert for the inmates there. So we were all roots lovers. We're roots men. We want the 7-inch singles by the most obscure artists making conscious music with incredible bands behind them and spreading that form of reggae music, because that's what uplifts you. And when I started the Reggae Beat in 1979, we were on the air for 6 weeks when Island Records called us up and said, would you mind going on the road for 2 weeks with Bob Marley? And we did. And during our time, Hank Holmes and I asked Bob, since we had the only radio show at LA playing reggae, and we were brand new, only 6-7 weeks old, what advice he had for us. And he says, always remember one thing, Roja. He never called me Roger. It was Roja. That's where I got my Ras Roja name from. Roja, come here. Always remember one thing, Roja. This music is not just for jollification. It's for education. So that was our motto during all the years we were on the air together. You can have fun, but listen to the words too, because they mean something. They take you to a higher level of consciousness.
Have you watched the Marley movie?
Twice.
What do you think of it as a Marley historian?
Total fiction. It's as if they took the chapters of Bob's life and shuffled them like a deck of cards. All kinds of ahistoric things happening. That said, I want everybody to see it because it mythologizes him. It writes important people in his life out of his life. It tells stories that didn't happen or totally out of sync. But if you go to a musical movie thinking you're going to see a documentary, there's something wrong with you. And it's a musical. Just say to yourself, it's a musical. Music is great. See it on a big screen before it goes away. But if you're looking for that period of time's history, there's no better documentary than the one on Netflix called Who Shot Bob Marley. Have you seen it?
Who Shot the Sheriff?
No. Who Shot Bob Marley?
Oh, that's a different one. There's
one on Netflix.
There's one on Netflix called Who Shot the Sheriff?
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I thought it was Who Shot Bob Marley.
But maybe they have two titles, but it's called Who Shot the Sheriff.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that covers the assassination attempt through Smile Jamaica. Smile Jamaica through the peace concert, which is exactly what the Marley movie does too. But it interviews people who were there when Bob was shot, and people who were with him in England when he was in exile, and people who were playing on stage with him at the One Love Peace concert. It tells the true story, and it gets Siaga to admit as much as he ever admitted just before he died that he was aware of what was going on. And since Jim Brown was one of the chief shooters, I mean, it's been obvious to anybody who understands Jamaican politics where the attack came from. But Siaga always had insulation of one or two people between a wish and an action, as all good politicians must. And far be it for me to make any critical remarks about Jamaican politics. It doesn't concern me. I'm an American, and I try to stay out of other people's business. But I have seen things and heard things and read things and watched things.
You made a comment in the Independent about Danny Sims. Did you know about the relationship with Danny Sims? Or did you have a relationship with Danny Sims? And why is his story left out of the Bob Marley story? I interviewed his daughter, and she told me that she owns or manages the catalog that Danny left from Cayman Music. So tell me what you know about Danny Sims and his
know a hell of a lot about him. I worked for him for 6 years. I met him in 1981, right after Bob died. Let's just say when I was putting a massive collection together with Bruno Bloom in Paris called The Complete Bob Marley and the Wailers, 1967 to 72, getting all the uncollected Jamaican singles that Danny had the rights to in one place, the first time Selassie's The Chapel was ever made available to the public. Tread Along by Bunny, Sugar Sugar, the Wailers cover of the Archies. A lot of fascinating tracks. And Bruno and I worked on that series for 6 years. And during that time, I forget what it was, but I asked Danny if he could get me something. And he says, I could get you anything. I'm a mobster. So he never made any, he always admitted that he was close to Joe Armoni, who was one of the prime mafia members at that time in New York. And Bob was basically owned by the mob for 4 years, from 68 to 72, until Danny sold Bob's contract, bought it back from CBS, Columbia in London, and sold it to Chris Blackwell with a 2-point override of everything Bob would write until 1976. And those are valuable copyrights. So Bob started hiding them under other people's names like Tartar, Vincent Ford, who never wrote No Woman, No Cry. Bob wrote that song. And Tyrone Downey wrote Waiting in Vain, and Waya Lindo wrote Redemption Song, but they're all released under Bob's name. Did you know that?
Yeah. I heard the stories. I looked at it. But
have you read my book? Have you read my oral history?
I have it. I haven't read it as yet. I am now on Timothy White's.
Listen, put Timothy White's book down right now. Timothy White's
I'm done
book
with it. I read it twice. Crap. I'm on your book next.
There's so much crap in that book. Made up bedtime conversations on the door in Coxon's back room. How did he know what they were whispering in each other's ears? And
I thought no, that
this is not a reliable book. It has been discredited by so many people over the past 20, 40 years.
Yeah.
You want to read a really good book, pick up Stephen Davis's book, which has never been out of print. It's just called Bob Marley, Stephen Davis. That's a great book. He wrote it at the same time Timothy wrote his. This, now, that book was called by Rolling Stone, no less, maybe the best Bob Marley book ever. And it took me 15 years to write.
So I'm on it next. That's what I'm
all right.
On.
I hope yours doesn't take 15 years, Donovan.
No, this is my fourth book I'm dropping, right? I write a lot every single day.
Oh, good for you.
Because I run the magazine, right?
Right.
And my topics are very focused on music business. Even if we drop a little gossip, it comes back to music business and reggae, dancehall, Afrobeats, Latin, pop, hip hop. Just the business we deal with. So this book that is basically complete, but you're fascinating my mind right now because I'm elsewhere with it, what you're giving me now. My last book was about how to turn the cultural capital into financial capital, which is about marketing. But now I'm zeroing in on the numbers because nobody ever dealt with how to sell reggae. And that's a problem that's imminent right now.
Yes.
It has the balance of culture and commercialization, and that's what I'm dealing with. But I want to know, why do they leave out Danny Sims out of the Bob Marley?
Okay, yeah, that's... there is another movie that's been in the works for 20 years about the Danny Sims story, which would feature prominently Skill Cole and in certain sections, Bob. It has to. And it's a great script. I've been an advisor to it all these years. And I think maybe now it has a good chance of getting made. I don't think the relationship between the Marley estate and Danny Sims, even to this day, is very good. So they're not going to...
That's where he was on his last days?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no love lost between them, let's just say that. And anyway, that period that the film covers, Danny wasn't in the picture. Danny was basically out of the way from 73 to 79 when he wormed his way back in. And I don't think he belonged in the Marley movie.
That no, wasn't... not the movie. Whenever you hear about Bob Marley, you hear that it's one man that took him to the world, Chris Blackwell. You never heard what.
Well, Danny tried to take him to the world, and the world didn't care for him. But maybe that's because Danny made him sing songs like Milkshake and Potato Chips, which was the one song we left off the so-called Complete Wailers box sets because it was too embarrassing. We didn't want to do that to Bob. It wasn't written by him. It was written by Jimmy Norman, who wrote a lot of the Cowsills hits for Danny. I mean, Danny tried everything to break Bob, and he just couldn't get airplay. I mean, it was the psychedelic 60s at the end of that decade, And reggae, well, it was just beginning to be reggae, didn't fit into anybody's playlist, despite the huge success internationally of the Israelites by Desmond Dekker and the Aces, which claims to have sold 6 million copies worldwide. But there was no real follow-up to that. And reggae, the word never came into my consciousness until 1973. And I was tuned into music in a big way. It would have been interesting to see if Bob had stayed alive, because Danny would have had an influence on his life again. And
let's go back to reggae music and the dancehall music, right? There's a point where reggae was the popular music. And then the switch happened when you said in the 80s, when you said you stopped playing reggae, right? But dancehall was what clamored to hip hop. It wasn't reggae that joined with hip hop, it was dancehall, because Supercat, all of them guys, they were merging, and hip hop was coming, dancehall was coming. So why do you think hip hop did this and dancehall is still inching way behind?
The patois.
But reggaeton came after both.
But that's not reggae. That's not reggae.
It's dancehall.
It's a whole different thing. Yeah.
Now I'm saying reggaeton is not English, but it's flourishing in English-speaking countries.
Yeah.
So why do you think dancehall is not selling when the Jamaican does it?
That's impossible for me to say, because I'm really out of touch with current runnings. I'm not nuts about hip hop or dancehall. If I were probably 30 years younger, I probably would be in it, because I made my living for 11 years performing poetry, and that's what that's all about, you know. But it's street poetry. It's angry. It's rapid fire. It's assault of the beat is like a cell door slamming over and over and over and over. And it doesn't
I
get.
I guess the thought I'm sharing, I'm trying to get from you, is what did you learn from reggae then that could be applied now? Because reggae was popping.
Boy, if I knew that, I'd start a label. I don't really know how to answer that, Donovan. I want the roots to come to the fore again, and people make beautiful music. The problem is, and I've been criticized for this over the years, to any of the newer generations, how do you reinvent the wheel? I mean, every generation needs artists of their own age to restate the eternal verities and give them a different shape for a new time. I understand that. And how many times can you make a song about Rastafari better than anything Ross Michael ever did? Or how do you... You know what I'm saying. I mean, there were so many superstar quality Jamaican artists at the height of their powers in the 70s. Just phenomenal, you know, a God-blessed time on earth. And it was in the face of overwhelming odds, and they maintained the purity of their sound. What greater vocal group has ever existed than the Mighty Diamonds? You know, can you imagine Jamaica without the catalog of the Mighty Diamonds? And Tabby's murder. Inexcusable, just unbelievable that a Jamaican would do that to Tabby Diamonds. Just disgusting. Tabby was a really good friend.
That's another thing I want to talk to you about, the catalogs, right? Oris Andy, I interviewed him. He said he has not been paid 40 years from Trojan Records. Several other artists from the time. Max Romeo suing Universal Records. Same thing. Say he hasn't been paid. They owe him $15 million. What do you think happened at that time where artists just were not compensated for their golden voices?
Well, the producers kept them stupid. I'm sorry, not stupid. They're not stupid at all, but ignorant. They didn't want them to know. I mean, one of the reasons Joe Higgs didn't get really out of the sky or into another, you know, bout of major stardom was because he wouldn't sign his compositions over to the producers. And he kept all his masters himself. Joe Higgs was one of my closest friends for 20 years, and the stories he told me were just heartbreaking. So what the producers did was take everything they possibly could from the artist, never sign any deals with them or sign deals where they gave away their rights to the producers. And then the producers would sell those masters, like Lee Perry notoriously did, to four or five different record companies all at the same time. If you want to read some of that stuff, go read Copeland Forbes' book. I love Copeland's book, but it's frightening. You know, it tells all the reasons why what you're asking me took place.
Yeah, I interviewed Copeland and we spoke about that, but I'm listening to your perspective totally in this conversation. So is there, are you saying that just because they were ignorant, record labels took advantage of them? But as a historian, with all, you're able to value your catalog, right? From what you collected, and you own all of this heritage curated. But these guys, they don't own anything. They haven't curated anything, even though they're the ones that were. Even Bob Marley doesn't own his music. He lost the lawsuit. Well, Rita Marley lost the lawsuit with Universal in 2010, right?
Yeah.
What's your principle, I'm trying to get, on that recouping process and that compensation process that BMG has not come forward with and other record labels?
I think they're just waiting for all these classic artists to drop dead so they can forget about them. It's terrible. You know, the music business is permeated with gangsterism. You know that. Everybody knows that. Not just America, not just Jamaica. It's the music business. They're all a bunch of crooks. And they're making their billions off the sweat of a lot of people who could use a little money in their pocket, some dunza for their work. And I'm entirely in favor of the artist's demands as far as that goes. Absolutely 100% behind them. They should give whatever Max Romeo deserves and do it quick before he's gone, you know? Yeah, I was the national promotions director of Island Records for a brief time in the mid 80s. I did Confrontation, I did Night Nurse. My favorite project at the time was King Sunny Ade. I did his two Island albums. Michael Smith, the dub poet, Black Uhuru. And Chris would never tell me sales figures. I was the only one promoting reggae in America for Island Mango. And he says, why do you want to know? And I said, well, you know, I'm your only promo guy on this stuff. The stuff that's selling, Confrontation, whatever, they don't need me. But what isn't selling so I can put my energy behind that and see what we can do for the artist? Oh, you just keep doing what you're doing. You're doing a fine job. And a year later, he came into my office and said, I simply can't afford to promote reggae and African music in America anymore, so you've got 2 weeks to get out. And that's the way things go, man.
Would you ever, have you seen the Book of Hov display in New York by Jay-Z?
Mm-mm.
So Rock Nation had a whole museum. They turned the Brooklyn Library into...
Oh, I read about that. Yeah, yeah. It looks incredible.
Would you digitize the catalog you have now in such a fashion?
All of a sudden, Donovan, the image of a bunch of medieval scribes bent over their desks with a quill pen copying the Bible rushes into my mind. You can't see all this stuff. I'm on a big screen computer on my desk, or I carry my phone around, and that I don't own a cell phone, and show you all the rooms and the drawers behind me here with eight huge file drawers just of Bob Marley clippings. You know, you get to need a lot of people spending a lot of time scanning a lot of stuff, but it's possible. It is not impossible. But, you know, maybe a benefactor in Jamaica will put some money into hiring Jamaican people, students at the university, whatever, to digitize all that stuff and make it available to the whole world. You know, the more people see it, the better it is for Jamaica.
I'm just thinking in this time when AI, TikTok, everything, people are consuming things, there is a way to make it shareable and experiential. Like the Bob Marley One Love experience, I could see a lot of stuff that you have, that this is more than Marley, right? This is the music from Jamaica. I could see kids who are into iPads enjoying stuff that happened in the 1970s in a technological way that's just serving to them.
What Joe Bogdanovich and I and his people have talked about is a really immersive experience. And we've got one of the greatest museum experts, who's also a huge reggae head, advising us. I can't talk about any of these details until I sign the contract, but you understand. Yeah. And we're going to tell a story. And you're going to go in there and you're going to be overwhelmed. Like in these drawers over here, I've got 30,000 reggae flyers from all over the world going back 40 years. And I want a room that you walk into that is just covered from floor to ceiling, just enveloped by all of this incredibly rich art created all around the world because Jamaica created a reggae music for the world to enjoy. How does that sound?
All right, that sounds good. And we're going to end there. I thank you so much, Roger Steffens.
Thank you so much. I love meeting you here today. I look forward to many more collaborations. Congratulations on your work, and may job continue to bless you, my brother.
All right. Thank you so much. All right.
One love.